the Buddhist philosophy from the very start, the notion of path acquired a totally different meaning. Path is sorry for using a philosophical term, but I want you to get used to philosophical terms. Yes? Let me assure you, you won't die. Yes. It is not that difficult. Yes. Because path in Buddhism, transcendental notion, is transcendental in European philosophy. Quick, Andrew. I think, first of all, forgive me for correcting you, it is beyond our perceptions, our own normal perceptions. So path, yes, from here to downtown, yes. And that is why, and it is extremely important not to understand, because I cannot understand it like you. Because I do like you to understand it, and you are too like me to understand it. Because the path is a transcendental notion, because it is outside the realm of our ordinary language and ordinary thinking. That is why you may say, God, so many millions of people are on the Buddhist path, so what? So what? When I recently read a terrible, unimaginable description of the pogroms in Colombo and Sri Lanka, never read it, yes? When the Buddhists, like Muslims, like Christians, like adherents of any other religion in Colombo, made one of the most terrible massacres, yes? And all of them there, formally, officially Buddhists. And each of them may tell you, I am on the path. Yes. It's the same with Christians, yes, who also from time to time make pogroms and massacres. You heard about that, yes, probably. Now, but that is because of our non-understanding of the idea of path. Because path is a kind of general possibility, or I would even say probably. No more than that. So if one is fully initiated Buddhist and on the path, it still does not prevent that one from being a bandit, looter, rapist, yes, and whatnot. That you must understand, or you will never understand a single word of Buddhist philosophy. It's only possibility and probability. You understand it, yes? And all the rest is words, words, words. Now let us return to the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. The second suffering has its cause, its origin, yes. Whereas in Pali and Sanskrit, dukkha samudaya, yes. But again, it sounds very simple, but it is not at all simple. Due to the very, very complicated character of the Buddhist idea of causation. Yes. Now, let me tell you a few words, because it is of one of the most difficult philosophical ideas in the whole history of philosophy. For us, as in the case of path, causality is very simple in its most primitive, pseudological, post-Aristotelian way, yes. Causality means that B has its cause in A, or more exactly, would be, so to say, B had it's in here is a kind of the first twist in our understanding of causality, because it's the Buddhist philosophy. For instance, the cause of anything means not only that something was the cause that produced that anything. That is, we take into account the notion of what? Andrew, time, yes? While in the Buddhist philosophy, causality means the cause is that which at each and every moment of time continues to be the cause. It is the beginning of the Pratitya Samutpada, the law of interdependent origination. The primary cause of suffering is avidya. But it does not mean that, oh, there was a remote time when there was a primary, primordial, pristine ignorance. Yes, radish. There was not such a time. Because it is primary. In the sense that it was producing suffering. It is producing suffering of each and every moment. And it will be producing suffering into eternity. Now, the suffering, that's the last step in that law of interdependent origination, Paticca Samuppada, or in Sanskrit, Pratitya Samuppada, the law of interdependent origination, at the very bottom of which is ignorance, nescience, you know. That inexorable law in Buddhist philosophy, in fact, is the first law, which is a permanent, sorry to say it in Latin, causa what? Efficiency. It continues its efficiency. Or we may even say that there was no time when that cause were not producing. And to understand that it is very pertinent for understanding the whole Buddhist philosophy. Cause is that which now, 100 million years ago and in the future, produces it. And the effect is suffering, yes? On the louder, please.
Pardon.
I'm listening to you.
Oh, okay. Now, if ignorance is always has been, always is, and always will be the cause of suffering,
yes,
then how can anyone hope to end suffering?
That is a very, very pertinent question. Because the annulment of suffering as its production, shall we call it production? By the way, both in Sanskrit and Pali, it is called production of suffering. Yes, and its annulment as well as production can be imagined only in steps, in stages. That is, you are annulling one of the steps in this long, beginningless chain of causation. And you, in a way, go back, not in time, but in the sequence of those stages, which are, in a way, timeless. But now, let me start with the most essential points in that law of interdependent origination, and then I will devote the entire lesson to that law. Now, on the sort of shortest sketch, to give you, as it were, the taste of how was it thought. Now, let us start again with the first explanation of that first basic element in the law of interdependent origination. There can be no such thing as ignorance. The question will be what? Ignorance of what? And you say that Mr. Jones is ignorant and Albert Einstein is a genius, yes. You mean that Mr. Jones is ignorant of the special and general theory of relativity, yes. While Mr. Einstein invented both. And par excellence, he knew both, etc. But, you know, this philosophy, and in the context of the law of interdependent origination, ignorance is not ignorance in general, but ignorance of that which leads, which is directed to the extinction of suffering. In order to know how to win suffering, yes, you have to know first of all that what have you to win, to abolish, to get rid of, to reject. In the first place, in the second place, in the third place. And now I will give you a very, very short epitome of that law. So, the ignorance is in the first place, of course, in the final account, in the final analysis, it is ignorance how to get to, of how to get to the state of the exhaustion and cessation of suffering. And it is how means the path. It is ignorance of the path. But now that ignorance, first of all, is ignorance of that, ladies and gentlemen, it is the most important philosophical moment. Yes, how to win suffering? What is that? What is that which is ignorance? What is that which is ignorance? It is not only ignorance of what? Ignorance of the path towards nirvana, towards exhaustion and cessation of suffering. But then the question is unavoidable. But who is going to be suffering? Let's answer, quick.
Yourself.
Sorry? Louder.
Suffering?
Yes. Who is suffering now? Start understanding. Yes? Continue to think. This is your own self. Unfortunately, there is no self, yes. You start your Buddhist philosophy with that. There is no self. There is no such an entity as self. I may say, oh, I myself, I prefer weak cigarettes to strong. Here, I will be what? A mere what? Sanction. Or shall we say, a way of expression. A mere language. Because I as I does not exist in Buddhism. I is merely what? A way of saying the things. I prefer deep cigarettes to that. Well, I do not like drinking before 6 o'clock in the evening, yes. I do not like politics, I do not like television, yes. I like mountains and other rubbish, yes. Here, I is a subject of most elementary and primitive activity in its linguistic expression. But then, self, myself, what is myself? In Buddhism, there is no such a thing as self, the principle or lakshana of anatta, anatma. There is no such an entity as self. There is only what? Bubbling, chatting. Yes, I like this, I do not like that. Language. And that is when the Buddha asked two learned Brahmins who came to him for wisdom, saying, self, self, how does it smell? Yes, how does it taste? Where is that self? Show it to me, etc., etc. That is the Buddhist approach, philosophical, primary philosophical approach to self was purely empiricist. Ah, you cannot find it, you cannot show it to me, then forget about that. Yes. And such, please.
I'm pretty sure I've been following what you're saying. However, the Buddha says, when he's talking to Dhyana, I am free from anger, free from passion. I abide the night in there.
In the same way as I prefer weak secrets to the strong ones, because Buddha was talking to him.
Farmer.
To normal people, to you, to me, to a merchant, to farmer. So he used the normal language and say, I am free. In this very sense, that I am thirsty, I am hungry. And that is why there was a theory or myth that language used by Buddha was not Buddha's real language. And from which, yes, originated another myth, you remember it, of the silent Buddha, that he remained silent. That what we call Buddha Vachana, Buddha's words, only outwardly, linguistically, reflects the truth. Because the truth remains and remained unsaid, yes. And then, on the level of philosophical truth, there is no self, there is no real entity, there is no real being behind, I like, I do not like, I prefer, I am free, etc. You understand it, yes? So it is to talk. We are here to talk, what can I do? Buddha would have said, I have to teach you, but I cannot teach you in the language of truth, of the highest truth. I can teach you only in your own language. Yes, unfortunately, we have done. Who is suffering? And the ignorance, the nascence, first of all concerns who and what is suffering. Because there is no such an entity. And in the final analysis, we may say, yes, later I will explain to you in detail that what is suffering. Now, let me ask you a very simple question, which one of the excellent Buddhologists of our time, you heard of him, Professor Valpola Radovan. You heard of him, yes? Yes, I was present at one of his last lectures, yes. He used to say, if you cannot understand that, who is suffering, what is suffering, try to think, can you suffer when you are unconscious? Can you suffer when you are unconscious? When she is unconscious, can she suffer? When he is unconscious? No. And then Professor Valpola Radovan says, it may help us to understand that what is suffering is, in the final analysis, what? So, consciousness. And then we may call suffering what? Universal state of consciousness. And it is non-understanding, nessence of that what suffers, that it is consciousness. Because there is no real I, it's only word, there is only English word, Sanskrit word I, devoid of any reality. But what really suffer, what can suffer, is consciousness. And then Bhagavad Dukkha is the most universal, most general state of consciousness. Nevertheless, we simple people continuing to be ignorant, we still stick to our eyes as something real. By the way, I am absolutely real, as what? Professor Alexander Pyatigorsky. I am absolutely real, as Professor. What the hell does it mean? Professor Alexander Pyatigorsky, mere names, empty names. Yes. Labels, yes. My name may be written down or remain in words, yes, it doesn't matter. It does not say anything about the essence which is called so, because it is not the essence. Now, but we are coming to the next stage of the law of the interdependent origin. It is not the essence. It is only name. What I think is my I is name. Professor Alexander Pyatigorsky. Name. Remember the term? Nama. The same as in English? N-A-M-M-A. Nama. Yes.
You said that the self cannot suffer because it cannot see or touch or shoot, but can you show me, can you?
No, yes, because I am conscious of it. I am conscious of it. If you subtract conscious of it, then I am will be hanging in there. What then will become of it? Conscious of it, in my consciousness. But without my being conscious of it and your being conscious of my words and of my image, of my bodily image, without that, there is nothing left. And then, again, in the context of the law of the interdependent origination, then we are the other problem. The other problem arises, but still, there is a name. And again, it's very interesting. In fact, it is name, Nama. Not of non-existing me, yes, but of what? Of what is conscious? And what the other people or living beings may be conscious of while seeing. So, in fact, then, the whole complex, yes, is name, that is, in fact, the name of consciousness. And form, yes, you remember me as form, yes. Ugly enough, yes, I admit, yes. As a form, together with voice, yes, but now appears the notion in the context of the law of interdependent origination of nama-rupa, name-form, which we mistakenly, consider some essence, some special being, some special entity called I, which was totally denied in the Buddhist philosophy. But on the smallest day depression, ladies and gentlemen. And the one of the pupils said to the Buddha in a totally different and much later dialogue, okay teacher, then let us forbid, let us prohibit the use of the word I. And again it will be the extreme. You say, let us prohibit, let us forbade the term. But why? Because, it is a very important position. Because Buddha said, if you are so afraid of the word, it means that word has a real meaning. While for me, why not use it? Why not use it? We are using the word table, face, house, without being afraid. But there is no such an entity as table, as house, yes, or anything else. It will be again another extreme, but remember, and it is one of the very important positions of Buddhist philosophy. Words of, don't endow words with an special philosophical meanings. Because we cannot get rid of our language, or if we will, then the whole idea of what teaching will disappear, and thereby the whole idea of path, yes. Because you are either teaching or being taught on your path to Nirvana, yes. And it may be and partly can be achieved in reach in language. So no denying of language, but language, philosophically speaking, must have its place. It must not be transformed in a universal notion and the focus of all philosophy, as it was where, Andrew? In which philosophy?
Western philosophy.
Okay, no, but first of all, It's the beginning of the Tractatus. By the way, Buddha said to Wittgenstein, listen, old chap, it is not that bad, your Tractatus. Yes, your Tractatus is not bad. It is an example of sheer exaggeration. You are even right on some moments, but on the whole it is a linguistical extreme. Now, so there is no I, there is Nama Rupa, where Nama name denotes consciousness and Rupa form denotes what vaguely speaking your role on the mind form. We think of ourselves and of other people as names and forms, but without any endowing them with being, yes, they are not being, but what then are they? I have already touched upon that very quickly. Not being. One form. 2 seconds and a half ago, another form. Now I'm alive, next moment killed. Now I'm conscious, next moment, yes, unconscious. So it is again a conventional name for a very complex not elementary, but very complex phenomenon, nama-rupa, in the Bhagavad. Then we are coming to another stage in the law of the interdependent origination. It's the fourth notion which I am offering now to your thinking. And it is a very... try to remember the name of that notion. Samskara, or samskara, S-A-M-S-K-A-R-A, samskara. I repeat it, S-A-M, yes, in the European prefix, sam, yes, corresponds to Latin word. Com, C-O-M, and to Greek, sin, yes, yes. Some is together with, combined with, sanskara. It is that notion denotes a special kind of energy, of impersonal energy, of impersonal energies, which hold together that which we call a thing, or a thought, or a phenomenon. That is, when we speak about this table, we perceive it as what? Object of what?
Sight.
Of touch, first of all. Object of sight. In its color, and it is in its external form, yes, then you may smell it if you want, you may hear the sound. So it is a combination of various modalities corresponding to each of your order of senses. And besides that, you understand that it is table, yes. And that it is a word, and that you understand with the help of which organ of sense? Quick, mind, in Sanskrit, manas, the same word, Latin mens, yes. You remember under your legend, yes. Yes?
No.
Yes, you know, so it is a combination of very many modalities and modifications of sensual and mental character. But they exist as one object, which is the table, only because there are special energies which hold all those modalities, modifications, features, all those sensual objects together. So there is no such an essence. In this respect, Buddhism may be regarded as very, very anti-Platonian, yes. There is no tableness in Buddhism, yes. As there is no I-ness, there is only combination, in a way, temporary combination, of various sub-phenomena and sub-sub-phenomena of various qualities, etc., which are held together by special energies called samskaras. Samskaras in Pali, sankaras. Yes, you got it. And they have a great importance in the Buddhist philosophy. And so, one of the factors of ignorance of that first moment in the law, that say, due to our ignorance, we take this table as a kind of entity. That is, we think of it, using philosophical terminology, yes, as an ontological entity, yes. And we think of ourselves as ontological entities, but it is only due to the work of those energies which hold everything, all different objects together as different objects. We may talk of table as a table. So it is sanskaras which determine the ideas, the thoughts of various phenomena in their, each of them entirety, but first of all it applies to I. There is no such a thing as I. It is only due to those energies, or that is why some of the Buddhologists call them synergies, combined energies. We may speak and think of I, may think and speak of me as myself, but they are continually in work. And then we may finish that preliminary sketch about the love of the interdependent origination with that sake Buddhist corollary. Of course, what is then that of which, minded, not of whom, of which I am speaking as of me? I, myself. And Buddha said, there is no such a thing, it would be better, simply as I. What in fact there is, it is the five different things taken together by sanskara. The first, rupa, form, body, yes, rupa, which I can see. The second, what I can feel, yes, what I can feel. I can feel tiredness. Sometimes I am tired at the end of a lecture, yes, or hunger, I am a bit hungry and definitely thirsty. What is that? It is a second element. So the first is what? Form, body, rupa. The second is my emotions, my feelings, yes. Never exaggerate your emotions and feelings, yes. But it is enough, they usually exaggerate themselves, yes. Now, the third, but at the same time, I see you around and myself here in this room. So at work, what is also my perceptional ability, yes? And not only ability of perception, but ability of expressing that perception in what? In words, of language. So we are coming to the third component. So the first, rupa, form, body. The second, feelings, vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A, vedana. And the third, perception, samjna, S-A-M-J-N-A, samjna. Perception, rupa, vedana, sanjna, and the fourth element is what? Those very energies holding together, in this particular case, myself, my active impulses for continuation. No, don't tell me that I am nothing in Buddhism. and nobody in real life. I'm holding myself, yes. Usually they are called active volitive energies, that is will, yes. And they are called, I told you, sanskaras. It is the fourth element.